Thank you all for showing up at an ungodly hour on a Tuesday morning. Obviously, I am neither Edward nor am I Bruce Jennings. Unfortunately, Dr. Jennings was coming from New York City yesterday, and I think we all know that certain things have been happening on the East Coast. Many of us are not getting home for a couple of days, but so he asked me to step in. Because of that, there's going to be some slight changes to our approach today. We'll still have our regular panel of speakers, and it's really exciting that two of these speakers are actually students or recent graduates. So in many ways, I mean, this is a real opportunity to sort of hear from the next generation, not us old fogies who you constantly hear. But the change that we're going to make is rather than having a discussant who is supposed to be Dr. Jennings, and I have not had the opportunity to review these materials, instead we're going to extend each of the speakers' time and allow them to answer a couple questions after each talk, and then open it up for just a panel of questions at the very end. And so each speaker will be given about 20 minutes to present and answer a couple of questions, and then at the end we'll bring everyone back up. Before we start, I just want to remind everyone of a couple things. You can pick these up front or in the back. These outline all of the events that are being sponsored, or not sponsored, but hosted by the Ethics Special Primary Interest Group. Some of these were yesterday. We have four different sessions today, as well as our business meeting tonight at 6:30 in Esplanade Ballroom 301. As the outgoing chair of the Ethics SPIG, I want to encourage you all to come, even if you're not a SPIG member, so that we can recruit you. So take a look at that. On the back is also some information about the Ethics SPIG and why we feel that ethics is such a vital and important part of this association. I'd also like to ask you all to turn off your cell phones and any other electronic devices, simply because in some past sessions there's been some funny incidents where Siri was answering questions and things like that. So if you could do that, I'd appreciate that. So with that, what I'd like to do is invite our first speaker up. And our first speaker is Dr. Catherine Womack, who's actually a friend and colleague of mine. And she's a professor of philosophy at Bridgewater State University in Massachusetts. And her research is at the intersection of epistemology and ethics and focuses on how beliefs and embedded practices influence behavior, particularly with respect to eating and activity. And she has a number of recent publications in Public Health Ethics and the International Journal of Feminist Approaches to Bioethics, or IJFAB, which, if you've never heard of it, oh, it's probably, I think, one of the best journals out there. And I'm an editor, so I'm not allowed to say that. So with that, I'd like to invite Catherine up, who's going to be speaking on clinical expertise, scientific knowledge and trust, epistemic and ethical challenges to managing the public's health. Catherine?
So I'd like to thank Edward for organizing the Ethics Special Interest Group sessions this year. They really seem quite excellent. I have to do something really unnatural, which is stand here. So I will do my best. This session is being recorded. Plus, I can't actually see the screen. Okay. First of all, I have no personal financial relationships to disclose. So this talk is on what to do when there are disconnects between scientific research and clinical practice. There's been an awful lot written on what to do at disseminating scientific research to the lay public, but not as much about some of the gaps between clinicians and scientific researchers. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Okay, so a good way to get started is taking a look at the recent firestorm following the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force 2009 report on breast cancer screening. You can see here a an excerpt from their report, but the key feature is that they recommended against routine mammography screening in women ages 40 to 49. And what happened? Fury. vitriol, firestorm. So the American Society of Breast Surgeons said that we believe the recommendations turn back the clock to pre-mammography days, even though, in fact, it turns out that clinical practice in Europe is already in line with USPSTF recommendations, and they know that. So they say they're going to continue to advocate for routine annual mammography screening. Susan G. Komen takes a slightly different tack and says, questions the certainty of the findings and says there's enough uncertainty about the age at which mammography should begin that we wouldn't want to see a change in policy. A lot more pushback. The American Cancer Society came out swinging. They said, with the new recommendations, the USPSTF is essentially telling women that mammography at age 40 to 45 saves lives, just not enough of them. And they, the American Cancer Society has access to research. They've done their own meta-analyses. So they actually knew what the results of the USPS task force would be. It was no surprise to them. So they say they acknowledge the limitations of mammography, but they say as a global grassroots force of more than 3 million volunteers, we fight for every birthday threatened by every cancer in every community. American College of Radiology piles on, calls it a step backward, and Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius advises that people should just keep doing what they've been doing for years. So in this battle over the message, who was winning? Well, we have this kind of showdown. On the one hand, we have the message, early detection saves lives, versus a new randomized controlled study that estimates the number needed to invite to screening to extend one woman's life as 1904 for women aged 40 to 49 and 1339 for women aged 50 to 59. Although the relative risk reduction is nearly identical for these two age groups, the risk for breast cancer increases steeply, so the absolute risk reduction from screening, as shown by the number needed to invite to screen, is greater for these women. And here's my one picture. So what should we do when you've got scientific research that is proposing an overturn of existing clinical practice? I'm not actually looking at sort of what exactly we do politically. That's a different talk. This is what we do epistemically. How do we convey knowledge claims and reach consensus about shared beliefs and reasons for beliefs? Okay, one strategy for achieving scientific and clinical consensus is to unpack and explain scientific reasoning. So there's some terms that were that all of us in this room are familiar with that were there in the report. One is the number needed to treat. In the mammography case, they talked about the number needed to invite to screen. A hugely important distinction is the distinction between relative risk reduction and absolute risk reduction. Many studies have shown that lots of physicians and other healthcare providers are unable to articulate the distinction between absolute risk reduction and relative risk reduction, and therefore they don't tend to use it in their clinical recommendations and explanations to their patients. Furthermore, I just picked this one term, this quote, current evidence is insufficient to assess. This doesn't mean we don't know. What, in fact, the USPSTF has a rather rigorous and well-articulated grading system of recommendations. It's fairly scientifically rigorous, and this has a technical meaning. But not everyone knows that. So, is this a good strategy? If it were, my talk would be over in 30 seconds, so no. All right, here's some problems with the strategy. The first one I like to call the expertise gap. My dissertation advisor, who was a logician, told me that he liked to say that when someone was having trouble following a complicated section of a long proof and asked him for some clarification, his strategy was this. He would repeat what he had just said, only slower and louder. Unfortunately, the slower and louder strategy doesn't tend to help. So, what are we actually seeing that's going on? There seems to be a failure to reveal the values behind scientific analysis. What are some of these values? There are different understandings and tolerances of risk. There are different ways of weighting the different types of evidence that go into scientific assessment and conclusion. There are even different notions of what counts as evidence. So we have randomized controlled trials, and we have prospective studies, we have pilot studies, we have qualitative studies, we have individual patient case studies, we have anecdotal reports from clinicians, all kinds of reportings that we have to make decisions about how to weight. There are also different needs for scientific knowledge. Clinicians have the imperative of caring for patients and versus scientific research and scientific research panels, which have the job to establish best practices. Furthermore, we have different positions. There's the front line, the position of frontline patient care versus the position of being a lab scientist or a researcher who's publishing in a peer-reviewed journal. Okay, so in a 1999 article, Cabana et al. Took on this question, and you can see from the title that they're actually locating the problem in physician adherence. I love this, by the way. So physicians are non-adherent to clinical practice guidelines. They have a nice model that they divide up. On the left side, you've got epistemic barriers, familiarity, awareness. They may simply have beliefs that conflict with the specific guidelines. But on the right side, they refer to affective problems. People don't outcome expectancy. They don't believe the clinical guidelines are going to work. They don't think they can put them into practice. They're not inclined to change their current practices. But what this does is this model acknowledges no possibility that physicians might be authorities for revising clinical practice guidelines. Okay, so here's my suggestion. So let's use some of the tools of epistemic but not ethical, but epistemic pluralism. Well, just a reminder for the non-philosophers in the audience. So what's ethical pluralism? There are many different theories of value offering conflicting answers to important moral questions, or they list different moral values as basic. Say, some prioritize justice, others prioritize beneficence, etc. The key thing is that these theories may be incommensurable. That is to say, there isn't any way to adjudicate among them. We don't have one agreed upon lever, epistemic lever. And what they do is force us to embrace and tolerate multiple practices within one community. Epistemic pluralism is, in fact, a more shocking view than ethical pluralism, in my view, because what it says is that there are different theories of evidence giving rise to conflicting knowledge claims that prioritize different epistemic virtues. So some prioritize explanatory value, maybe generalizability, maybe fit with experience, maybe rigor. And these are all different, and different theories are going to prioritize these different things. What they do is force reevaluation of what counts as an authority and a reason. Am I at 5 minutes? Okay. Oh, wow. Okay. I should sit down. Anyway, all right. What I now want to do is turn to looking at one case and another set of recommendations. The first is a Don Berwick article from 2009 recounting his experiences on an Institute of Medicine committee on quality of healthcare. Every public health ethics talk I give has to have a Don Berwick article in it. So the committee that was trying to figure out what counts as quality of healthcare came up with six aims: safety, effectiveness, patient control, timeliness, efficiency, and equity. The problem is that the first two, safety and effectiveness, tended to trump all of the other ones. So when anybody brought up, you know, some other problem, they said, oh no, but that conflicts with safety and effectiveness. Some of the old radicals on the committee, of which I think Don Berwick was one, said, what would happen if we put patient control first? Well, what would happen is that it gives rise to a conflict. There's sort of two views from which one can generate views about quality of care. One is the professional view, the view that medicine's a profession. You need to trust us. Right? So put your faith in us. We are the authorities. We're going to do what's right. Which is, that gives rise to quality health care is give patients the care they need. Another view is the consumerist view, so that patients are customers, the customer is always right. So that means that good quality health care involves giving patients the care they want. And that means every MRI that they asked for. You can see how this gives rise to a lot of conflict. Well, one suggested resolution was to cede some epistemic authority to patients, families, and practitioners. Why? Because they have access to experiential evidence of quality care. And this evidence would be useful for practitioners, hospitals, public health programs, and insurance. So by ceding epistemic authority and taking into account patient desires, Berwick tells a story in which they were able to construct some consensus and some plans to yield better health outcomes. So the consensus, even though they have rival views about what, you know, whether a patient should get a particular test or not, they could find consensus in lower costs, better health outcomes, and patient and provider satisfaction. This is obviously a work in progress, but this is an example of using epistemic pluralism to find consensus, not at the level of certain sets of belief structures, but with respect to goals. Okay, this is my last one. I'm so sorry. Why did it do that? So this is a New England Journal of Medicine 2011 editorial on narrative medicine, and the authors make two suggestions for use of narrative by scientific panels like the USPSTF. So I just want to talk about both of those. The first one is this. In the case of mammography screening, when the American Cancer Society responds by saying, here's Rachel. Rachel's 41 years old. She has no history of breast cancer. She went in for her regular mammogram, and yes, they found something. So she had breast cancer. She went to Dana-Farber, got her treatment, and now she's fine, and they show a picture of her with her three children. As response, the authors are suggesting that scientific panels should in fact respond with their own stories. And there are such stories to be told. So we know from the sort of anti-vaccination movement that medical authorities have been using stories of infants in ICU with whooping cough. This is the kind of thing that happens when you don't vaccinate. So with respect to other sorts of stories, they give an example. You could tell stories of patient experiences with Avastin for metastatic breast cancer. It turns out Avastin doesn't have isn't proven to have much improvement, but they're really nasty and potentially life-threatening threatening side effects. So again, you can tell these stories by putting a face to your position. So that's one way. The other way that they suggest, and these are both doctors, so I'm not sure they know how philosophically, how philosophically radical this is. They suggest that scientific panels and scientific policy panels construct a narrative about the process of scientific discovery and translation. So this is the idea, you tell the USPS, TF reality show story of, you know, with the cast of characters and the conflicts, the nature of the deliberations, the reservations that people have, the suspense before the actual vote, and then, you know, plans for the future. So, but all joking aside, what this does is it breaks down the wall between the context of discovery and the context of justification. So what this is doing is saying the process that we went through in order to reach the process that we went through of sifting through the evidence and the process of building the consensus and coming to conclusions is evidentiarily relevant and should provide convincing evidence on its own for the conclusions that we reach. So this is an example, you know, of social epistemology in action by taking into account the contexts, the viewpoints, the group interactions, the psychological processes underlying belief formation that lead to conclusion. Okay, last slide. So how can stories like this support pluralism and consensus with respect to clinical uptake of scientific recommendations? One, stories can expand our cultural competence to include clinicians' methods, which may be localized, not generalizable, formalized. So we actually take seriously clinicians' ways of knowing. And finally, this is kind of a mouthful, different epistemic interests will guide medical researchers and practitioners to different kinds of explanation-seeking questions. This is what DeVries et al. Said, which is to say medical researchers are looking for certain kinds of explanations, clinicians are looking for other kinds of explanations. Making explicit what kind of explanations we're looking for and why can reveal areas of common interest to come to more of a shared understanding and shared buy-in for scientific recommendations. Thank you.
For those of you who joined us late, we're actually not going to have a discussion because he's tracking the book. So instead, we're going to open it up for a couple questions for Dr. Womack, and then at the end, we'll bring everyone back up to answer questions. So anyone has a question for Catherine?
The orange one is as we approach in a We Are the Experts, you know, what we are doing, isn't that going back to paternalism? Doctor-patient relationship?
Yes, absolutely. So in fact, what I am suggesting is by using epistemic pluralism, you are avoiding paternalism, because what you're doing is you're giving epistemic standing to all the stakeholders in a particular discussion about a clinical recommendation. That is to say, you've got, you know, patient groups, and you've got families, you've got clinical practitioners of various sorts, and you have scientific researchers, right? So, and by engaging in a discussion where you make explicit both what your knowledge claims are and why it is you care about the position that you have, right? What came into that, whether it's your clinical experience or your need, or your area of expertise, then everybody can reach consensus. It's not that you have to convince me that what I believe is wrong, right, or vice versa, but we can have these, in fact, conflicting, not, you know, beliefs, but we
we can find consensus about what to do and how to do it by engaging in a common process of explaining how it is that we got to where we are. I know this is complicated and I don't have much time, but I think it is decidedly non-paternalistic because it's not the case of a scientist saying, sit down, I'm going to give you the sheet of paper telling you what to do. It's tell me why you think this. I'll tell you why I think that. Let's keep talking until we reach some
decision. So you're bringing communicative action into the words of tolerance.
Correct.
To broaden the issue and really the same level of knowledge that is going to go
to create shared knowledge despite a background of conflicting beliefs.
Are you sure?
Do you know groups that are actually doing this in like an applied way, or is it still, or is it kind of a conceptual kind of new way of thinking moving forward? So like how would someone do this? Is it at a national conference? Is it conference calls? Is it
Yes. Anecdotally, there are plenty of cases of this, and there's one. People can do this through websites. So, like, there's this disease called LAM, which I can't remember. It's a pulmonary disease that women in their 20s, 30s get. I can give you their website, and it's very rare. The researchers are working with the patients who are giving experiential reports about drugs and dosages and side effects and the trajectory of their disease, because nobody's going to get a big enough group to do any kind of trial. And they're not doing trials. They're actually, in fact, communicating, and everybody's trying to increase their knowledge of this. So this is in the early stages of discovery. With respect to clinical recommendations, there's Don Berwick's case, right, and in community-based participatory research, you have a lot of cases. You know, we've got people at the Heart Science End that are working with this. And feminist bioethics, this is one of the big things.